Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. And the styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. So I've been using Armoire and I'm actually wearing one of their shirts right now as I'm recording this, and it's a great idea. You don't have to commit to buying the clothes, but you can really start to explore your own personal style. Like if there's a trend or something that you've been wanting to maybe try but not commit to, this is absolutely perfect. Because if you don't like it, you just put it back in the bag and get something else. Because we've all been there. You open your closet, and even though it's packed, you feel like you have nothing to wear. And with Armoire, that's a thing of the past. They make it effortless for all women to turn heads with stylish everyday looks. You can rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion, and it's all tailored to your personal style. Plus, you don't have to do laundry, and you don't have to go shopping. It truly could not be any easier. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month, which is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/ATTWG. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/ATTWG to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then she can either type a response or use their voice to text feature, and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy. It's something that you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. And this is something that Ethan and I had been thinking about doing with our parents. We have this podcasting equipment, so we wanted to find a way for them to tell their story. But I love this because it's so regimented. They send them a question every week, and it just makes it really easy and turnkey. And it just seems like a great way for us to get our parents' stories down so that our children and our children's children can have them. So if you're interested, check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG at checkout for 15% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG for 15% off today. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, like, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick. that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. I remember the ribbons tied around trees and posts in the Leesburg, Virginia apartment complex where I lived with my mother and younger sister in 1994. They were hung for a boy, the son of the apartment complex's maintenance man. Victor Shoemaker was a tall, quiet man who seemed to be as much a part of the place as the playground, the pool, or the brick facade of the buildings. I never recall him talking much or hassling the kids who ran wild while our parents, many of whom were single mothers, worked full-time. But then the ribbons showed up and the neighbors started talking. On a weekend off, Victor had taken his family, his wife Nettie and their 5-year-old son Victor Jr., also known as JR, to visit family in the mountains of nearby West Virginia. Victor and Nettie returned, but JR would never see his home again. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Victor Dwight J.R. Shoemaker. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everybody.
Welcome to our special one-year anniversary episode.
Yes. So this is the very first episode that we did, but we are re-recording it because I did not know how to record things. And the first episode, if you listen to it with headphones, I'm in one ear and Ethan's in the other. It was not great. So I figured that part out for a second episode. But yeah, the first episode was not great. So we are re-recording. So this is Victor J.R. Shoemaker Taylor's version.
Lame.
Whatever. It's a great joke.
That's like your version of a dad joke.
Yeah, except better.
No, it's so good. It's exactly the same.
No, it's so good.
So lame.
So good. Yeah, so thank you so much to everyone who has been with us since the beginning, which I think everybody who's like literally been with us since the beginning, as in what listened to our episode like the first week it came out, is only our family, I would have to assume.
Probably, yeah. Or maybe close friends.
Doubtful.
They may have come on in the second or third episode. I don't know.
I don't know. But we do have a lot of people who have said that they've like gone back and listened to everything, which is like so embarrassing to me because I don't know. It just it's so hard. But anyway,
hey, look, we're indie podcasters.
Like, we are.
You know, this is all trial and error for us.
Yeah. So thank you so much, everybody who supported us, who subscribed, who's downloaded, like especially those of you who have left a review. God
yes.
bless you.
Yes, thank you.
Oh my gosh. And
also thank you for the big ego boost. I've gotten a lot of reviews recently that have been mentioning that I'm doing a good job. So yeah. I appreciate that a lot.
He's very fragile. He needs it, you guys. He really does. Yeah, so it's been a really fun year. I think this has been a really fun thing for us to do together. And I've learned a lot. I've been really into true crime since probably around the third grade when, granted, it's not true crime, but I started watching Alfred Hitchcock Presents on Nick at Night.
It was my favorite show.
Third grade, you said?
When I was like nine, yeah.
It's what every 9-year-old, eight or 9-year-old needs to
watch. Yeah, however old you are.
Needs to watch.
Yeah, and then in fifth grade, we had an assignment where we had to write a play based on a book that we read. And my friend Steve did Freckle Juice, and I did the true crime classic, Missy's Murder. And his play was 3 pages, mine was 10, and it was very gruesome. I don't know. Like, if it were now, I would be in therapy. I would, you know, it would just not be a good scene.
Yeah, CYS would have been called on your family.
Yeah, you could have got, you got away with a lot of shit in the 90s is basically my point there.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, I would just, I started reading true crime books, like, as a small child.
Also, I want to point out your age and that when you were 8 years old, it was still the 80s.
All right. Well, no, this is in fifth grade and it was the 90s. So you can go straight to hell. Also, we're the same age.
I realize that. I'm just saying.
Okay. Well,
I thought you said third grade before.
No, third grade is when I started being creepy. Fifth grade is when I wrote that play.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So we are going to retell the story, which, you know, has stayed with me since it happened in 1994. I was 13 years old. It was a weird thing to have something like this happen in your neighborhood.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, you know, because I was aware, like, because I had been a fan of America's Most Wanted since I was 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That was, like, a big part of my childhood. Anyway, this is not a therapy session, but... But I was very aware that bad things could happen to people from a very young age.
I think that was just a product of growing up in the 80s.
Maybe.
Because it was, you know, Unsolved Mysteries. It was America's Most Wanted. Like
Rescue 911.
Yeah. Like we everybody watched those as with their families. So
right.
I think it was kind of ingrained in our childhood, which is probably part of the product of why, you know, true crime podcasts and true crime everything is so popular now is because, you know, that's what we grew up with.
Yeah. No, I think that makes perfect sense. I think you're right.
Plus America, or not even America, just humans in general have a morbid obsession with, you know, crime and death.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So I was always aware that things like this could happen. But again, once it happens in your neighborhood, it's a totally different thing. And it's stuck with me for the past, gosh, it's been almost 30 years. I mean, this happened in 1994. We're in 2021.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest thing that happened to me when I was 13 was I almost got arrested for stealing the hoops off of a basketball hoop, the nets off of basketball hoops.
Why?
Well, I didn't do it. Somebody else did, but saw me there.
All right. Well, that's a whole other podcast. But
yeah, but I'm just saying, like that was like the biggest thing that happened to me. You know, I can't imagine going through what you went through.
Well, no. And I don't want to make it sound like this is something that happened to me though, because it really wasn't.
Right.
You know,
but
it's
it
just
was
something that happened around me, and it did affect me.
Yes.
But it did not happen to me. It happened to the Shoemaker family. So, all right, let's get into it. J.R. Shoemaker, Taylor's version.
Lame.
J.R. Shoemaker had just turned 5 on March 30th, 1994. An only child, he loved hanging out with his older cousins, 8-year-old Lloyd Wolford and 9-year-old Tommy Martin, and running around the woods on Short Mountain where his step-grandfather, Oscar Wolford, lived. The boys adored the woods. When they were together, they would go out and go a-huntin'. While often they would return with tales of big bucks they had killed, one time, JR's cousin Tommy actually killed a rabbit. And JR was so excited that he took off and ran on his own back to his step-grandfather's trailer to tell his mother all about it. JR may have been young, but he was trying to keep up with two older boys, and that made him scrappy, you know, and he knew his way around the woods. His mother, Nettie, had struggled for years to conceive and rarely let JR out of her sight, but she felt safe on the mountain. They were surrounded by family, and the setting was familiar. Their apartment in Leesburg certainly wasn't in a dangerous area, but it also wasn't in the best part of town. But on top of the mountain, surrounded by nature and family, Nettie felt at ease.
Well, especially with the fact that she could send him out with two older boys.
Exactly,
Who were also familiar with the area.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, they all knew the area. And yes, 8 and 9 years old doesn't sound like incredibly old or whatever, but, I think in a situation like that.
They're running around in the woods that's basically their backyard. Right. You know, like, yeah.
It's just a big backyard.
Sure. But I mean, I did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not at 5, but 8, 9.
Yeah. And so that's why on the morning of May 1st, 1994, she dressed JR in a red Bugs Bunny t-shirt, red shorts, and white X-Men sneakers, and sent him out to traverse the woods with his older cousins, as she had done countless times before. But when Lloyd and Tommy returned to the trailer at 8:30 a.m., they didn't come with tales of wild animals and forest adventures. They came with downcast eyes, and more importantly, they came back without JR. According to the two boys, they were out in the woods when JR said he was hungry. The older boys wanted to stay outside and play, so JR headed back to the trailer alone, but he never made it back.
Which, okay, on face value,
sounds like the most believable story that's ever been told.
Absolutely. Because, yeah, like, little kids get hungry all the time. And
like 5 minutes after you leave.
Yeah.
It's either I'm hungry, I have to go potty. Yeah. It's something. And it's always like immediately after you leave. Because, again, this was very quickly after she sent them out. They were not out for a very long time at all. In an interview that Nettie gave to the Virginia Pilot in December of 1994, she said that she asked the boys 3 times, quote, "Where's JR?" They said, quote, "He's up in the woods." She said, quote, "They never looked at me. Nothing," end quote.
So I've got so much that I want to say.
Yeah.
But I also want to hold off because obviously this is the second time hearing the story. But I want to hear the actual timeline and where this goes, because I already have theories popping off in my head. So,
well, so Nettie immediately sprang into action, and she and Victor started frantically combing the woods for their son. The problem is, for an hour, they were looking in the wrong place. You see, Lloyd and Tommy knew they were in trouble. They were only 8 and 9 years old, respectively, but they were in charge of looking after their younger cousin. On top of that, they knew they weren't supposed to play around the abandoned trailers that dotted the hillside. So they didn't immediately tell the adults that those abandoned trailers are where they last saw their little cousin.
So let's get into the abandoned trailers. What type of trailers are we talking about? Are we talking about, like, we're not talking fifth wheel trailers. We're talking about like mobile homes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Supported by cinder blocks, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Do we know, do these have septic systems? Do they have wells? Like, how are they getting their water?
That I do not know.
Okay.
I would assume they have wells, but I don't know that for a fact. Yeah. I think these are more or less like permanent dwellings.
Sure.
So my guess is that there's well and septic involved, but again, I cannot confirm that.
Yeah, the well would be what I'm interested in.
Yeah. But what I will say, after being a realtor and having to sometimes deal with more rural homes that are on well and septic, the well isn't a well. It's not a well that like a child can fall down, which I think is what you're thinking. Like, it's a very small area. It's capped. It's not.
Well, sure. But you're also talking about active homes.
Yeah.
So these are abandoned homes. And while I understand that the opening may be small,
mm-hmm.
they may not all be capped.
Yeah.
But that also will lead me into a different avenue.
Yeah.
As well.
I based on what I've seen, I just can't imagine that being an issue at all. But, you know.
But who was the famous girl that fell down the well in the
80s? Oh, baby Jessica.
Yeah, yeah. And that was the same thing. Like, the pipe was super small, but she was also...
But she's a baby. Yeah, she was a literal also, baby. Yeah, like, yeah. JR was five, you know? He was a kid.
Yeah. What are these abandoned homes... I don't want to say what are they being used for. They're abandoned, but like,
yeah.
Is this, are they known to have, to be places where drugs are being used? Are they known for prostitution?
Nothing I've read has indicated any of that. I mean, this seems like a pretty remote location, not busy, not in any sort of a town. Like, I think they were just abandoned. I haven't read anything that would indicate that even squatters are there or anything of that nature.
Maybe teenagers using it as a drug spot.
Oh yeah, maybe, but I don't know.
Okay.
So the older boys eventually led the adults to the spot in the woods where they actually last saw JR, which was about a half mile from Oscar Wolford's trailer.
Did they say why they misled?
Well, yeah, because they knew they were in trouble and they weren't supposed to play in those abandoned trailers. Okay. So they like led them to some other place away from those trailers.
Gotcha.
Like just in the woods. They're like, oh, I don't know. We were just playing.
Yeah.
Who's here? But of course, Nettie and Victor were already panicking. Like JR knew these woods. If it was just a matter of him getting turned around on his way back, they would have heard or seen something by now. The shoemakers knew that something horrible had happened. The family called authorities, and before noon, the woods were teeming with police, firefighters, neighbors, and volunteers all searching for the lost little boy. And just to, again, remind you all of the timeline, so the older boys came back at about 8:30 a.m. without JR. They looked around for about an hour in the wrong place, and then looked in the quote-unquote right place, still couldn't find him, called authorities, which of course is not like a 3-minute response time up on the mountain.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know what time they called them, but you know, like they got there quickly for what they were able to do. So they got there before noon. So okay. Right now we're talking about 3.5 hours,
right,
give or take, between the time JR was last seen and when the full court press is called to go look for him. The search lasted throughout the day and into the night. Spirits started to flag as the sun went down and the night turned cold, with temperatures hovering right above freezing and a light rain falling. Searchers began to worry that JR, who is only 40 pounds and dressed in shorts and a t-shirt, may not fare well in these conditions. But hope wasn't lost. Robert J. Walker, chief of the local volunteer fire company 3, was one of the first to arrive on the scene. A few years previously, he had been involved in a similar search. Two young boys had gone missing nearby when they were visiting their grandparents. Rescuers searched throughout the night and found the boys the next morning, alive, huddled up next to a log. He hoped the story would have a similar swift and happy resolution. But night fell, the sun rose, and still there was no trace of JR. The next day, Monday, May 2nd, the Assembly of God Church in Kirby became a 24-hour command post for the search. The entire county seemingly came out to look for the lost little boy in the woods. The local McDonald's donated food and drinks to the search parties, and by that Thursday, when JR had still not been found, over 400 volunteers came out from Virginia, West Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and even North Carolina to help find JR. Hundreds of acres were searched. Authorities used helicopters with heat-seeking sensors. Divers searched bodies of water. Even local school children were allowed to miss class to help with the effort. But despite all of that, not a single clue was found.
You brought up divers, mm-hmm, and bodies of water. Do we know what types of bodies of water were in the area? Are we talking quarries? Are we talking lakes, rivers?
I know there were some like streams, mm-hmm, you know, kind of shallow, small bodies of water nearby. I'm not aware of any quarries very close by.
And the only reason why I bring that up is because obviously quarries are extremely deep.
Deep, yes.
So it would be very difficult, mm-hmm, to find somebody in a quarry versus a lake or even a shallow river.
Right. So by this time, people were, of course, coming up with theories about what could have possibly happened to JR. One of the initial suspicions is that JR fell victim to a careless hunter. Hunters were common on Short Mountain, and accidents, you know, they do happen. But if JR had been inadvertently shot by a hunter, surely someone would have heard something or seen some trace of the boy, but there was nothing.
Well, and I also don't think that the two cousins would have covered that up.
No.
Like, even if the hunter threatened them or whatever, like, once they get back to their family, like, why would they continue to lie about it, you know?
Yeah, and I'm not a gunshot expert, obviously, but they were about a half mile from the trailer, and I feel like if a hunting rifle, I don't know, like, could that have been heard?
For sure, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like that's pretty close for a gunshot.
Yes, but we also don't know the terrain, you know, was it damp that morning?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, all of those things. What time of year was this?
May.
May? Okay, so it was...
So not a ton of leaves on the trees, some, I would think.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been
wouldn't have been complete foliage. But,
right.
I mean, so there's a lot of factors that play into sounds of gunshots or whatever. You also, you just said that hunters were common, so, you know, maybe hearing gunshots was a common thing. All that aside, blood spatter.
Well, exactly. So there's no blood found anywhere. But even beyond that, yes, hunters were common up there, but it was a Sunday and hunting was illegal in West Virginia on Sundays. So had somebody heard a gunshot, it would have been noticed.
Then it would have been noticed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of an easy cop out.
Yeah.
Know? To say it was a hunter. And then, like, so why would the hunter cover that up? Like, it was an accident.
Well, I mean,
it's tragic.
If it's an accident and you kill a 5-year-old, like, there's a lot of incentive to try to cover that up.
I think there's a lot more incentive to just try and get help and come out with it.
Okay. Like, this is very different from a year ago when we were, like, recording our first episode, because now I think people know you and, like, you are, like, the cutest, most optimistic, like, cinnamon bun person in the world. Like, you just, like, think the world is so much better than it is.
Okay, but if you go to the lengths of covering it up,
yeah,
and then it gets found out, like, then that's murder. It's, of course, it is,
but, like,
it's
what
not an accident
about
anymore.
About this world makes you think people are rational. Anyway, I do not think it was a careless hunter.
No,
Nobody really thinks that. Like, that was one of those things that was an initial theory, but it's not a theory that has lasted by any means. And I think as far as initial theories go, it's fine. But it's an easy theory to exactly. Well, that's what I mean.
Just,
like,
throw out.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you're talking about the woods and the mountains and West Virginia, a hunter makes sense. But it was not a theory that stood the test of time. Another theory was that JR simply got lost in the woods. Perhaps he fell and injured himself, or maybe an animal got him. But again, with that, people were looking for him so quickly after he disappeared. The three boys left at around 8 a.m., and Lloyd and Tommy were back by 8:30. So it seems somewhat unbelievable to me that no one would find a single trace of him, like no blood, no clothing, nothing at all.
Yeah. what animal is snatching a 5-year-old in the woods of West Virginia and completely consuming their body? Like, that's not
right.
That's
in
not
30 minutes,
yes,
or less.
Also all of their clothes.
Yeah.
Like,
and tennis shoes. And yeah.
Like, there's, I'm from Pennsylvania. I'm from Western PA.
Yeah.
Which is basically West Virginia.
Right.
There's not a whole lot of, like, human killers.
Right.
In the woods in that area. Maybe a grizzly, but they are also not known to hunt human beings and
yeah,
then eat them.
And leave no trace.
Yes.
I don't think they're known for covering their tracks.
They're also
so
not known for having a particular liking to like rubber soled sneakers.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like that's, it's far fetched to say an animal did this.
Yeah, I would say just because of the time. I think in general, you know, if we're talking about an adult hiker who is out for days on their own and then maybe something, maybe they fell, they injured themselves, something happened with an animal, like whatever, whatever, I could kind of somehow believe that.
You'd still find traces of them.
I would agree too. But like, yeah, when we're talking about a child and people are looking for him within a half an hour, I can't believe that there's no trace.
Yeah, I agree. It's not an animal.
But then, of course, there are more sinister theories that JR ran into someone in the woods who meant to do him harm. His mother, Nettie, told the Virginian Pilot that JR was a friendly boy who she could see being easily enticed by a stranger. Plus, the boys were playing around those abandoned trailers, and, you know, who knows if they were truly abandoned. For their part, the Shoemakers believe they weren't given the whole story. Nettie Shoemaker told the Virginian Pilot that she believes Lloyd and Tommy, who were kids afraid of being in trouble, didn't tell them everything that happened, saying, quote, "I still say the two boys know something. I'm not saying they're guilty of anything. I'm saying they have to know something. Somebody had to have taken him off the hill," end quote.
To the point of somebody taking him, I think that if there was a child molester, child abductor up there, I think we've said this on other episodes, but like they would have to have been the luckiest child abductor ever.
Right. You know, right.
It's not a playground.
Yeah.
You know, this is not an area where somebody that is looking or searching for a child to abduct or sexually assault or whatever, they're not going to be looking at this area. It's not frequented by kids.
Exactly.
Most abductions in that nature do not, it's not happenstance. It's not the luck of the draw. It's that they were casing a certain area where kids or a child frequented, and it was either targeted at the area or the child, him or herself.
Yeah.
It's not this circumstance where they were playing in the woods some random weekend and they were playing in an area where they weren't supposed to be.
Well, okay, but the only thing I will say about that, and I do agree with you, like I agree with you in so much as I do not think that it was a case where some child kidnapper coincidentally happened to be traversing the woods at the exact same place on Short Mountain, West Virginia,
right,
and got this kid. The only thing I will say possibly is that these children and this family, the step-grandfather lived here, and these kids came here often. This was a regular thing. So if there was somebody who knew the family, who knew these kids, who knew that they played around there, that to me could be a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you that as a possibility, but I would also agree with JR's mom, who said that the older cousins know something.
Right.
Because this didn't happen without their presence.
Right, and I would agree with that. I would say that if that was the case, if a third party was involved.
If. It's a big if.
Such a big if. I don't think it's a complete stranger. I don't think it was the happenstance, but you're right. I don't think it could have happened, even though they said that JR said he was hungry and he wanted to go back to the trailer. Like, I don't believe that whatever happened could have happened without the older boys having seen something.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So I don't know. But again, I just like, it's so hard because yes, all these people are adults now, but like, I hate the idea of calling small children liars or.
Well, I mean, look, they're 8 and 9 years old,
mm-hmm.
You know, and we see it we saw it when our older kids were 8 and 9 years old, how they didn't want to get caught in
whatever,
whatever, and they would make shit up. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're seeing that in our 3-year-old when I confront him and say, you know, who are you talking to like that disrespectfully? And he points at his brother and says, I'm talking to him. Like, you know, there is human nature to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, they don't want to get caught in something.
Yeah.
The problem is that it's persisted for 30 years.
Right. And, you know, going back to when it happened, like police, of course, tried to determine if the cousins did, in fact, know more about what happened to JR than they initially told the adults, because I'm sure everybody was kind of thinking the same thing, right?
Yeah.
They administered lie detector tests and even had them go through a play therapy exam. The results of both indicated that the boys were being truthful. We're not talking 100% scientific, you know, anything.
No, for sure. But
I do trust the results of like any sort of polygraph on children, I think, more than I would on adults.
But so
because I think like kids can lie, but they're not actually that good at it.
Well, no, they're terrible at it. Except for the fact that these kids did lie initially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what I would be curious as to what questions were asked. And of course, we're not going to know this.
No.
But polygraphers can only ask yes and no questions.
Right.
The truth determination is simple things like, do you know what happened to JR?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes, no, maybe, whatever. The play sessions.
Yeah, the play therapy.
The play therapy would be more revealing,
right,
as far as answers go.
I would agree.
But I don't know what questions were asked, so I don't know whether they were using that therapy session to find answers in the case or just finding out whether they were telling the truth or not.
Yeah.
You know, those are two different areas to explore. The polygraph is only going to tell you truth or lying, mm-hmm, and that's not 100% accurate. And then the play therapy session probably should have been geared towards finding answers. Mm-hmm. And maybe it was, and we don't know, but I would just be curious as to where that was going.
Yeah. And I don't know, but all I do know is that both of those sessions made the investigators think that the boys didn't know any more than what they were saying. And of course, the cousins were not the only ones who took polygraphs in connection with JR's disappearance, because obviously, ultimately, like, police did not suspect children of really doing anything.
No, that would just be to find out if they knew any more information.
Exactly. So JR's father, Victor Sr., and Tommy's mother, Sherilyn Musselman, both passed polygraph exams as well.
Well, weren't they at the house?
Yeah.
At the time?
Yeah. But, you know, you never know. Like, you gotta interview everyone.
No, absolutely. Do everything,
yeah,
of course. But, you know, as far as when he went missing, they were at the house with JR's parents.
Yes. But they have to determine if, I mean, because that's their story, right? But they have to determine if that's even true.
Right, right.
You know, that's we're true. Treating it as fact now, 27 years later, but like, the police can't treat that as fact in 1994.
Right.
With no further answers coming from the family and absolutely no clues being recovered from the woods where JR went missing, investigators were at a loss. Days turned into weeks, which stretched into months, and still they were no closer to finding JR than they had been when Nettie first tore into the woods, calling his name within minutes of his disappearance. Many people thought that the most likely explanation was that JR succumbed to the elements and that he would eventually be found somewhere on the mountain. However, there were some who believed that JR fell victim to foul play, and this belief would soon take the investigation into an entirely new direction. In November of 1994, 6 months after JR was last seen, the FBI got involved under the jurisdiction of the federal kidnapping law. This means that the agency, who had been monitoring the situation since the beginning, thought that there was a chance that someone had taken the 5-year-old across state lines. In that same Virginian Pilot article, Wells L. Morrison, the special agent supervising the case, wouldn't give much insight into the reasons the FBI got involved, saying only, quote, "The FBI considers this matter to be a high priority investigation," end quote. Despite the FBI's involvement, the case grew colder and colder. As 1994 drew to a close, authorities had seemingly exhausted every possible avenue. Weeks after his disappearance, JR's case was featured on America's Most Wanted. Shortly after, the National Guard was called in. They were followed by an Army Reserve Special Forces unit and 14 cadaver dogs. I remember watching that episode of America's Most Wanted.
Really?
Yeah. No, because I told you, like, I'd literally been watching that show since I was five. Like, I watched it every week. I was obsessed with it.
Yeah.
And by that time, we knew about JR. Like, we knew that he had disappeared. We knew that he had gone missing on a mountain, but we didn't really know anything else. Yeah. At least I didn't.
Yeah.
And then I remember somebody saying, like a neighbor or whatever, saying that he was going to be on America's Most Wanted. And even though I always watched the show because I loved it, like, I remember being in our apartment and like specifically tuning in to see that. And I remember being so sad because he was just featured very briefly at the end. So because I was such a fan of the show, like I was expecting a whole segment.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And he didn't get a segment. There, basically they did their two segments or whatever. And then at the end of the show, they did basically like a short segment of missing people across the country. And they showed several pictures of people who were missing, and he was one of them. So he just got a few seconds.
Well, that sucks.
Yeah. I mean, and now I get it, but yeah, I do remember like being kind of bummed that he got such a short period of time on the show, but it was still very, like, I knew that it was good that he was there because, you know, again, like they always tout like how many cases that they had solved or, you know, and so I had hoped that that would help bring him home. The show and the new searches did uncover potential clues. One of the bloodhounds appeared to catch JR's scent near a paved subdivision, the only way out of the woods by car. However, this was dismissed as a red herring by State Trooper C.J. Ellison, who had been on the case since the beginning. He claimed that too many people had trampled over that area for the scent to be reliable.
Well, if it's the only area that's accessible to the car, mm-hmm. Or to a car, then it stands to reason that that was probably used for the volunteers to input into the woods.
Yeah, sure.
The state troopers to go into the woods, to anybody that was going in to search for him probably went through there because it's not like they would. You know, where else are they going to put their cars?
Right. And I think that's probably 100% true. But would the dogs have picked up JR's scent because of that? Like, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a cadaver dog handler.
It depends. This also isn't the first time cadaver dogs have been in the area. So perhaps right. There was scent there left from something JR was wearing that the previous dogs, search dogs, was used to indoctrinate their scent. Because, you know, search dogs aren't just going to, cadaver dogs are different, but if it's a search dog, they're not just going to run around and randomly sniff out a five-year-old boy.
Yeah.
They'd be searching for a scent. So chances are those search dogs on the initial search were given a piece of his clothing mm-hmm. to sniff, and then they go and find that scent, or that's the scent they yeah. go after. So possibly that was there. Also, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. So Trooper Ellison, like I said, did say it was a red herring. But searchers also found footprints outside of a nearby home, leading some to believe that JR had sought shelter there. But the footprints were later determined to be too large. Other searchers revealed three rocks arranged in a triangle with a stick in the middle and three logs on the sides, leading some to speculate that JR tried to set up camp. But there was no physical evidence that the five-year-old had ever actually been there.
You mentioned the footprints being around a home.
Mm-hmm.
Was the homeowner ever interviewed, contacted?
So I don't know. I don't know if it was a home that was
occupied
or if it was one of the abandoned homes.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm not sure.
Okay.
Police were so desperate for clues that they weren't discounting anything, even psychic visions. Shortly after JR's disappearance, Trooper Ellison received a phone call from 41-year-old Louis G. Gonneau, a self-proclaimed psychic from Bridgeport, Ohio. According to the Virginia Pilot, Gonneau told Ellison, quote, "I seem to be the little boy. I'm on this hillside. The sun would move from my right to my left. There's a crevice to this hillside. I'm looking into a valley, not a deep valley. And straight ahead of me, there's this house. A shack, something of that nature, and there seems to be a hill behind it. Looking to the right of the shack, behind it, there are trees. To the left of the shack, the trees seem to diminish. As the hill drops straight down, there is a road there. Sitting there, looking down at the shack, the boy, I feel, ends up at the shack." End quote.
I just don't believe in psychic visions. To me, this is somebody that read or heard a lot about the case and knows the general terrain of West Virginia or researched that also. And people believe what they want to believe, but I don't believe in psychics at all.
Okay, but while the description of trees, a hillside, and a shack may seem generic, the man's vision gave Trooper Ellison chills. The location Gonneau was describing existed, and Ellison knew exactly where it was.
Why did he know that?
Well, because I think that Ellison is familiar with the terrain around where JR disappeared. And so, like, he was like, oh, yeah, the shack. Like, I know what you're talking about. And, okay, so not only that, but Gonneau had a track record of actually providing good information in cases like this. In late 1991, a West Virginia coal miner was swept away in a flood. Gonneau told authorities that he had a vision that the miner's body would be found in a creek under a bright yellow marking. And sure enough, in January of 1992, two beaver trappers found the miner in a creek under a tree stabbed with a bright yellow feather-tipped arrow.
So both of these cases are in West Virginia?
Yeah.
Sounds to me like somebody that's familiar with the terrain of West Virginia. I don't believe in psychics. Like, I can't. Good on Trooper Ellison for exploring all options, but I just wouldn't put a lot of stock in that.
Yeah, well, Gonneau had more to tell Ellison about JR's disappearance, including a second party who may have been involved. He told Trooper Ellison, quote, "There was a wild-looking person with a beard, long hair, that had something to do with this boy's disappearance. He seemed to be watching this boy as he moved through the forest. He knows the woods, but he doesn't know the boy. Now remember, when I'm the boy on the hill, that may mean I'm being guided to see what I need to see. The police keep missing something. There's only one vision I see every time. That is the little boy in a hole in the ground. I see it over and over again. Trapped. He seems to be in the fetal position. There's still some life energy there. I don't feel dead." End quote.
Very creepy, and yeah. it does go along the lines of what my theory of this case is, with the exception of the straggly-haired, long-bearded, stereotypical
creepy mountain man.
Yeah, I don't buy that for a minute. To me, again, that just goes back to somebody that knows the terrain of this part of West Virginia.
Yeah,
and I'll get into my theory later.
Okay. Well, despite whatever personal beliefs Ellison may have had about psychic visions, he knew that he had to follow every single lead.
Yeah, no, and good on him for doing that. I just wouldn't hold a whole lot of stock in it.
Yeah. So, you know, Ellison, after this, went to the woods, to the shack that Gano had seen, but there was no trace of the boy. Jer's disappearance and the lack of answers ripped his family apart. The shoemaker stopped talking to their family who was there that horrible day. While all of the family members were investigated and cleared of any involvement, Victor Shoemaker agrees with his wife Nettie that Jer's cousins, Lloyd and Tommy, weren't telling them everything. In 2014, the couple spoke to the Associated Press around the 20th anniversary of Jer's disappearance. Of the cousins, Victor said, quote, "I think they know what happened, but I don't think the boys heard him," end quote. If Lloyd and Tommy do know more about their cousin's disappearance, they're not talking. The Associated Press tried to reach them for an interview to no avail. The pair has given no information about Jer's case to the authorities, the press, or the shoemakers since 1994. Victor believes that someone took his son off that mountain. He said that it's possible that JR is still out there, but living under a new identity, saying, quote, "That's what we're hoping for, is that miracle," end quote.
Yeah, and I understand that that's what they need.
Yeah.
But I think it's far more likely, and this is my theory of the case, mm-hmm. is that the cousins and JR were playing around somewhere where they shouldn't have. And they were messing around and either pushed him or JR fell into either an abandoned mine shaft or a well that may have been big enough to fit a 5-year-old. They were so fearful of getting caught doing something that they weren't supposed to do that they lied about where they were to distract the police. Or not, it wasn't even the police at that point. It was their, well, it was, okay, more, that leads more justification to it. It's easy to distract your parents when law enforcement isn't there.
Right.
We're 27 years later mm-hmm. now. So like at this point, they've perpetuated this lie for so long that they're just going to continue and not say anything. I think that's far more likely than, again, the Wild Mountain Man or a random abductor just happening along where JR was. Even if that were the case, it's the same thing. I think the cousins know more. I would agree with JR's dad.
Yeah, and so do I. My problem with that is the kids were 8 and 9 years old. So I do not think that they did anything malicious.
No.
Right?
No.
And JR's parents, Nettie and Victor, also have never thought that the kids did anything malicious. Right? These guys are in their late 30s now.
So what would be the incentive for them to come clean now? They've gotten away with whatever it was.
Well, no, but it's not about getting away with it, because I don't think it was malicious. I think maybe there was some sort of accident or something that happened that they do know more. And, you know, they're in their mid to late 30s, and there's a good chance that they have kids of their own now, that they can empathize with parents who have been stuck for nearly 30 years, and they have been in the same place, not able to move on, not able to get on with their lives. This was their only child, and they live in the same apartment. They kept his room. Like, they have not moved on from this even a little bit. And I think that when you're in your mid to late 30s and you perhaps have children of your own, or, you know, nieces and nephews or whatever, you just get to that point in your life and you can understand truly what these people have been going through. I just have a hard time understanding the lack of empathy there.
Are we flipping scripts now? So now who's the innocent one that thinks that that there's good in the world?
Because I
truly think that while they probably do have kids, I truly believe that they're not empathizing with their aunt and uncle. They probably have not spoken to them since.
No, they haven't. I mean, So this, again, this AP article was in 2014. It was around the 20th anniversary.
Sure.
And I don't have any information, like any solid information after that. I do not have. But yes, in 20 years, they had not spoken to them or anyone else, presumably.
So don't you think it's would probably be easier for them to disregard and not necessarily forget, but put it out of their mind?
Yeah. Okay. I'll give you the putting out of
mind. Hey, look, I'm just saying there are people in this world that will never have empathy.
Okay. Okay. Sure. But we don't know anything about these kids.
You're right.
And we don't know that they're the type of people who would never have empathy. What I can buy is that they were able to disassociate and put it out of their mind. But I feel like a big part of the whole reason that we're doing this is to get these lesser known stories out there so that people can't forget. So that people, and I'm not just talking about these kids, I'm not just talking about this story, I'm talking about every single story that we have covered, that they cannot get this out of their mind. So that there's somebody out there, whether it's with this case, whether it's with any of the other 40 cases or whatever we've covered so far in this past year, I want to get their names out there so that anybody who might know something, whether they were involved or not, whether they had any malicious intent or not, that they can't just put it out of their mind, that they can't just rationalize it in a way that they can say, well, nobody remembers, this is over, this was in the past, we're in the present now. It's still here. These people, the families in every single one of these stories are living in their own personal hell that they have been living in since the day their loved one disappeared. And that has not gone away for any of them.
So obviously, I agree with you
on
all of those points. But that further backs up my point that this case has not been in the limelight.
Right. It hasn't.
That could very easily lead to them being able to disassociate from it. Again, I'm posing a theory of the case. I could be completely wrong.
I
have no idea. These two now adults could be absolutely 100%
telling the truth.
Yes.
Yeah.
It just seems to me that that would be the most rational explanation of what happened, that something happened up there. And again, not malicious intent, but they lied about it to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. And now here we are 27 years later, and they've been disassociated from that side of the family. Mm-hmm. And the story has dissolved into the background of society so much that they just don't talk about it. They don't think about it. It's probably somewhere in the back of their minds, but it's not something that they're willing to admit to.
Right.
Because that would fundamentally, even though there wouldn't be anything criminal about it, it may fundamentally alter their lives. And if there's no incentive for them to bring that up, why would they? Because not everybody is how did you describe me?
Just a cute, optimistic, cute,
optimistic Bambi
innocence.
Yet here you are doing the same thing.
I know.
We all have greater hopes for the world, but the reality is that the world is a dark, terrible place.
Yeah. I don't want him to be forgotten. And you're right. I couldn't get through this story without crying, and I couldn't get through it the first time either, but I think I did a good job of editing all of that out. But there's a reason that we did this as our first episode, because...
Well, because it shaped a part of your life. It stuck with you for this long.
Yeah. And the Shoemakers have lived every day waiting for a miracle that has yet to come. As far as I know, they still live in the same apartment in Leesburg, Virginia, the only home JR ever knew. JR's bedroom still has his Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle blanket on his twin bed. His bicycle with training wheels and his beloved Super Nintendo are also there, along with a shelf full of wrapped Christmas presents that he was never able to open. Reminders of their son are everywhere. The apartment is covered not only in photos taken during his first 5 years, but age-progressed versions of him that offer the family the only glimpse into the future of which they were robbed. Weeks after JR's disappearance, on a bright sunny day, I was playing around the apartment complex with my sister while her mom was at work. Victor came up to us and said something to the effect of, "You'd better be careful that you don't get lost." Without thinking, I shot back some stupid remark born from the arrogance of a 13-year-old doing something she had done a million times before. I was uncomfortable and I tried to make a joke out of the situation, but it wasn't a joke to Victor. "Sometimes," he said to me, his voice steady and his shoulders stooped, "kids get lost." Victor Dwight J.R. Shoemaker Jr. has been missing since May 1st, 1994. He would be 32 years old today. If you have any information at all about J.R.'s whereabouts, please contact West Virginia State Police at 304-822-3561 or the Federal Bureau of Investigation at 202-324-3000. You can see all of the sources for this episode in our show notes and on our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at @ATTWGPod on Instagram and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
Thank you for joining us for this special 1-year anniversary episode. And we will see you right back here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Dethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains May 2nd through the 12th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.